All right. So, I'm going to do something here, perhaps a bit dangerous, which is, well, perhaps you can see already, I'm going to give a chalk talk. And I'm basically, oh, I mean, I do have some organization here, but I basically want to have a conversation about some things and some things I've been thinking and directions I think we need to go in terms of studying evolution. So, that means that I'm hoping this will be more like a conversation to some extent than just a rattling off of research that I've done. And I'll probably refer to, I mean, I will refer to research that I've done, but I want to kind of get along more into the ideas of things. So the first thing I want to talk about a little bit is explain my title. Which is the evolution of memory foam, which I was told is provocative to some extent, I guess. But it's a real analogy to how we think proteins evolve, and to some extent, what I want to do here also is sort of question about whether that analogy can be extended up into the hierarchies of development and cell biology and things like that. So we published, I don't know, 2, 3 years ago now, something we call the evolutionary Stokes shift. And for the physicists, are there any physicists in the audience? Okay, fantastic. You guys know who Stokes is? Do you know what the Stokes shift is? No? But you do. So that's good. Rob Phillips knew right away what I was talking about with this too. But the Stokes shift is this idea when a molecule absorbs a photon of energy and goes to a higher energy state, that sometimes it'll go up and it'll release vibrational energy after it absorbs that photon. Okay? And then when it goes down, say if it moves back down and emits a photon back down to the lower state, that movement down will also then be in a higher energy state and will slowly release vibrational energy. Okay, so the sum total of that is that you, when you move up in state, you're going to absorb a photon with much higher energy or with at least higher energy than the photon you emit when you move back down. So you have an unequal exchange of energy because of the loss of energy to vibration in this whole process. So what you can think of is that as the Stokes shift a little bit, as the molecule initially having to be sort of making that transition in the high energy state and then sort of adjusting to what the structure, the new molecular state, if you will. And what we found, why we called this an evolutionary Stokes shift, is that we were doing protein modeling. And we discovered that essentially proteins do very much the same thing. Okay, so when you go from amino acids, let's say alanine to phenylalanine, say, could be any different amino acids, essentially, that initially you're in a state where if this exchange maybe was even close to neutral, these were essentially these two amino acids have roughly the same fitness. Okay, but over time, through coevolutionary interactions, you adjust to the amino acids that is there. Okay, and that means that the rest of the sequence is evolving. Okay? And essentially the way you can think about this is the rest of the sequence evolves, and every substitution that's going to occur is going to be a substitution that's compatible with this new amino acid. Okay? So the tendency is always that the sequence is going to be okay with this amino acid being here, essentially. Okay? But if you consider alanine, the amino acid that was formerly there, the sequence no longer has a way of caring about alanine, right? So that means any mutation in the rest of the sequence that makes alanine worse is perfectly fine because alanine's no longer there. Okay, so what that does is it means you have a tendency, this is over time, okay, if we look at say the fitness of the amino acid, okay, and I'm going to draw two amino acids, you have, let's say this is alanine, okay, so you have alanine, at a particular focal site, you're in alanine, and you're looking at the contribution to fitness from that alanine in that focal site, right? And at some point, you have this transition of alanine goes to phenylalanine. Sorry, proline. Yes, thank you. I took protein's structure from Michael Lovett, and that was my failure. It was on the test. I didn't bother to learn the single letter amino acids. I mostly know them, but sometimes I can make mistakes. Anyway, when it changes to proline, the fitness over time will tend to go down. Okay, and I'm going to put this in a dashed line to show that it's no longer the focal amino acid. Okay, and if we consider proline, I want to be consistent here. This is dashed. Okay, and it has this state. And what's going to happen is most of the time it's going to be low, but it's going to have drifted up to nearly equal, right? And then be like this from then on.
Why did it drift up before?
Because of drift, because it can. So purely chance. So this is an entirely reversible process. So there's nothing about what I'm saying, and I threw up a few different things here to talk about, but this works in detailed reversibility. So the problem here, the thing that can be confusing about it, is the detailed reversibility holds for the entire sequence. Okay? But if you consider at one site at a time, it doesn't look like it's in detailed reversibility. It looks like a forward process that you wouldn't think of as necessarily reversible. Does that make sense?
Is this a conjecture or something that
no.
you
no,
think it's been established? Or?
So this is published work. This is based on evolving molecules in a thermodynamic system. So we basically set up a energy function for each molecule specific to a structure, right? And we have a target structure, and we're evolving along the sequence along in that target structure, right? With no other selection except for the probability of folding. Okay, so all the fitness equals probability of folding to the target structure. So this is a consequence of really essentially entropy. Okay, so what I will say here is that in the context of a protein, or something evolving in the context of function that you think is evolving according to a thermodynamic system, this will happen. Okay, and we have good evidence that it happens in real protein systems. Okay.
Is the target structure in this case the proline?
No, the target structure is purple acid phosphatase. Okay, so this is what we're doing here is comparing this to a large set of decoy structures. Okay, so when we're doing the simulations, right, the probability of folding is calculated based on the relative delta G's, the relative free energies of the sequence of this, given the sequence in this structure versus this huge set of target structures. Yes?
So isn't another way of saying this that might be, at least to me, a little clearer than what you've written up there, is that prior to the shift at time t, you have 20 possible, you're considering only a particular site, you have 20 possible amino acids at that site, and what their fitness contribution would be varies over time
it does.
Based on the context of the protein as a whole. And there's no selection on that because they aren't even there. What's there is A, and that the typical fitness of A is usually quite high, right? So among the range of possibilities, there's no selection on 19 of them, but one of them remains reasonably high to the extent that it is selected.
So there's purifying selection.
So yep. now that you apply this change, what happens, and so that the mutation that's occurred presumably occurred from A to one of the amino acids that was actually high at that particular time, in this case, proline or phenylalanine or whatever you want it to be, and that is now maintained. And so it's not that A actively declines, it's that A sort of reverts to the, is now released from selection and it reverts to the same sort of cloud of fitness distributions that you saw for the other 19 amino acids prior.
Yep.
Well, I'm still back with Paul.
Yeah.
I'm not understanding why. So for phenylal or proline, I guess we're suddenly it's better there, then something has to happen in the background to make A worse. Right? I mean, it's all relative fitness. So A has gotten worse. So why do these other mutations
going to get to be the bad part of risking doing this as a chalk talk. Yeah.
Maybe. So I was going to ask, can you just go back a few steps? Just give us a bigger introduction to. I'm having trouble understanding what you're talking about as well. But maybe step back a little bit to like, what is the big picture here? And then
yeah, so that's why this stuff is here, actually, is to talk about this a little bit. So, let me do that in half a second because I want to answer what you said in the first place, and just give you some idea. I'm simply going to draw this as the relative fitness of amino. So essentially what I'm going to do is draw a little bit of an extended graph of this with all the amino acids. I'm not going to draw every single one, but just to give you an idea of what's going on. So what you're going to have, this is going to sum to one, okay? So they're all relative fitnesses. And as time goes along, there's random fluctuation in these relative fitnesses, right? So if you're starting out with alanine, in one particular instance, this is fluctuating up and down. Okay, now a lot of the other amino acid fitnesses are going to be fluctuating up and down.
And David,
down
those fluctuations
here
are due to accumulations of mutations at other positions in the protein.
They're simply coevolutionary interactions. So the evolution, this is driven, this is all driven by the evolution of the rest of the sequence.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're going to randomly have epistatic, you're going to have random epistatic interactions that are going to change the relative fitnesses of the amino acids at a particular focal site, right? So let's say 167. Yeah? No?
Yeah, no, I think it makes total sense to me, but I think that's okay. Something that may be useful to explain in a little bit more detail, how the simulation works and how the amino acids are changing at other locations in the protein and how that's leading to these observations.
Okay.
I think that...
Let me just try. I'm So look, I know that this is a complicated topic, and many of you are not used to thinking, except for the two physicists in the room, many of you are not used to thinking about thermodynamics much at all. And I'm trying to give an overview of something that's outside of various people's fields, for sure. What I want to get is that sometimes things will have rare fluctuations that bring these up closer to fitness, to this fitness, right? And I'm going to draw this as going down a little bit, right? Because you might have another amino acid that randomly drifts up to approximately equal fitness, okay? So this is essentially a random process with the constraint that A is probably never going to get really low in fitness because it's what's there. Whereas all of these other amino acids, the rest of the sequence is evolving along, not caring about all these amino acids that are not there. Okay, so I'm just showing you the fitnesses, the relative fitnesses of these other amino acids that we can calculate because we're doing a simulation. Okay, and if we're Dan, we could test these. We could go do mutagenesis and test them at any time. Okay, but these are fluctuating along, but it's only likely for a substitution to occur when the fitness of another amino acid becomes close enough to the relative fitness of the resident amino acid so that you can have an approximately neutral substitution between the two.
So maybe what the example of us, is that the amino acids don't really have fitness. It's individuals that have fitness, provided some definition. And then the question is, are we really talking about fluctuations? So fluctuations that you're talking about are due to the rest of the genomic context. Are we talking about additive? Are we talking about asexual? Are we talking about sexual?
Okay, so
where does where do the fluctuations that you're drawing there come
from? So selection doesn't really, I mean, the asexual, sexual, I think, is a bit of a complication we don't need to add in, which you can do whichever you prefer.
That would be one way
prefer.
To define fitness on the single locus.
So this is the relative contribution to fitness. Okay. So we can define this in various ways. You can define it, each one relative to another. Okay, and you can also define it in this context to the amino acid not being there. So what we have is the G of the sequence, the free energy of the sequence, is in this context the sum I'm gonna fully write this out, but I'm just going to write this out in words. So this is the sum across the sequence of the interactions between neighboring amino acids. So this is only in contact. Okay, and in this context, in our simulations, we're using this as a very simple a pseudo energy potential as contact energy. Okay, so we can think about that as the average. What it is done observationally from a lot of proteins, but it's essentially the average contact energy between two amino acids. I'm not sure if I'm not sure if this is going to help to go into this level of detail on this, which I didn't totally want to do.
This actually doesn't help, it hurts.
Okay. So,
Could you back up and just kind of give what is the big question that you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me think about how I can get that.
There's one other thing that you can help with too. I think you might be talking about absolute fitness too, right? Because relative fitness is beneficial, one's got to go above one. They don't sum it up on that.
Perhaps this is not so hard to understand. What I meant, what I said earlier is that we're calling fitness is the probability of folding, right? So if you just accept that I can calculate the probability of folding without explaining it all, okay, which I don't think everybody's going to get, I can ask the question if I take that amino acid out, okay, or I exchange it with another amino acid, what is the difference in fitness when I do that action?
Okay, so that actually helps a lot, right?
Okay.
Because you can certainly define protein stability, and people measure protein stability as a melting temperature,
mm-hmm.
and one can go and substitute every amino acid by as many as you care, and re-measure the melting temperature, and therefore stability. And then, of course, how to convert that into fitness is another long conversation. But at least to me right now, it explains sure. why you're actually writing delta G's there. And before I thought that they were written as some metaphors for fitness, and I have various problems with that. But if you really mean protein stability, then that's what it is.
I do really mean it, yes.
Right. And then certainly in some experiment, you can maybe conspire to select on the stability of a given protein and therefore make it a fitness.
Yeah. It's likely to be a component of fitness. So most people would think you have to fold at some point to a specific structure, or that the protein would need to fold to a specific structure in order to carry out its function. So there are other ways to model additional fitness, such as binding, right, or kinetic, doing catalysis, right? So I'm not saying that those aren't components, but what I'm saying is that we can take the system like this and model it and understand something about what we expect out of the evolutionary process. So we think that most molecules are thermodynamic. I mean, every molecule really is a thermodynamic molecule, and most things have to fold into a structure in order to carry out their function. Okay, so I'm gonna move us back a little bit, trying to get to what Shelley's talking about and sort of get back to a little bit of this the introductory stuff. Because what we're trying to do with this is we're trying to understand how evolution should proceed. Okay, so that is, what are our more natural expectations, which are not necessarily intuitive, from understanding that most functional molecules are evolving thermodynamic objects. Okay? So through a lot of evolutionary history and a lot of evolutionary theory, the study of evolution, we've done a lot of assuming things. Let's assume that we have a constant fitness landscape. Let's assume that the delta S's for every mutation do not change over time. Okay? So what we're trying to understand is the effects of coevolution and epistasis in protein molecules and what effects those have on the substitution process. So for example, are you all familiar with PAM matrices? Okay, so these are the classic point-adjusted mutation matrices. And what these are, we can think of these as from two. Okay, is you're getting substitution probabilities from one amino acid to the next. So we can do A, P, L, I, da, 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 down to W. A, P, L, I, dot, 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 down to W. Okay, and we have a diagonal line, which is self-self substitutions, which we don't really need to worry about for the moment. And each cell here is QIJ. Okay, it can be the probability of substituting from one amino acid to another. Okay, so that's normally every tree program that you use. If you use tree programs, if either at the nucleotide level or the amino acid level, is using some kind of substitution matrix. Okay? Now, it was common quite recently to use a single substitution matrix for every site, every position, and every protein. That is, assume these were constant. Okay? We're coming to understand that that assumption is both very, very wrong and potentially very, very dangerous, or at least it doesn't allow us to understand a lot of what's going on in protein evolution that we might want to understand. For example, we want to understand the effect of structure. Is there an effect of structural context on the probabilities of substitutions between amino acids? Okay, so do these vary across sites? Can we explain how they vary across sites? And do they vary over time? Okay, so what we have if we start to consider covolution and epistasis, right? And I wanna, I'm even gonna stop, go back a second and give a little definition of terms here. Because these get muddled quite often. Covolution and epistasis.
So experimentally, you're saying that, so I'm assuming that these values here that you're talking about were at some point based on experimental data, and you're saying that they've just been extrapolated to the point where...
So you can make observations of substitutions, and you can say this is the, and these are based on observations and saying what's the average probability that one amino acid goes to another,
okay,
across all sites,
okay,
and across all over time and across different proteins, right? So one can easily make the calculations to do this and get these substitutions and get these averages. Okay, so the problem, what I'd like to get across, is that I think this is broken. Okay. So a fundamental problem is that you have an average of a lot of processes going on. The properties of a diverse set of processes, okay, so, and by properties I mean anything you care to measure, do not necessarily equate to the properties of the average process. Okay, so that is, we're modeling evolution by saying this average process is the process that occurs at every site. Okay, that it's an average process occurring everywhere. But this average process actually occurs nowhere. Okay, it never happens. What we have is a huge variety of processes changing across sites and over time. Okay, now...
Safe to say that if you have a line of leucine, you get into a leucine, would generally be okay. And that's what's reflected in that matrix. So, I mean, on average, I think it captures some very important information about what can mutate to what.
It does.
Of course, it would not capture, like, fine details, like epistasis effect, but is that, I mean... So the question is, when do you need...
So what you're saying has been the argument for using these things.
Yeah.
And I'm making an argument that there are some very, very important details that are not covered by making that assumption.
Okay.
Okay, so, and mind you, I'm trying to go back to what Shelley is and just trying to say what overall what I'm trying to do here. Okay, so I'm not saying I've made that argument yet. I'm saying that's where we're going.
So for what type of, say, application or understanding is it important to go to
So most applications that you use these things for have to do with, for example, phylogenetics, ancestral reconstruction, like what Dan does, determining orthology and paralogy, trying to understand if something duplicated, did it alter its function? Okay, so we often want to detect, for example, the difference if we have an adaptive burst, if we have adaptive change, what happened? Okay. Often in evolutionary biology want to use convergence, okay, as a signal that adaptive evolution has occurred. Okay, so we try to do that from all levels, from the amino acid level to the phenotypic level. Really, pretty much anything you can think of in terms of making an inference about the evolutionary process and changes in the evolutionary process requires a model of evolution. Okay, is that, am I talking?
So for example, in Emmanuel's work, where I look at sticky patches, you know, if you have a something that's not sticky to sticky transition, its effect will depend on its neighbors, right? Where the threshold is. I mean, that's an example of the type of genetic background dependence that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't understand, David, is, I mean, so yeah. I won't give you an argument about how a PAM matrix fails to capture lots of important detail
Well, I'm going to make that argument.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess what maybe this is where you're going with is that I would like to know what you propose to do about that. I mean, we certainly all recognize that there are cases
yes.
that are different. The question is, what can you do about it at a generic modeling wide level?
There is the conundrum. Okay. So David has gotten to a major point, is that I can say that this is broken, right? And I can say that things are changing across sites and over time, right? But it becomes hopefully immediately apparent that if things are changing across sites and over time, then you're essentially talking potentially about a different matrix for every point in time.
In every position,
okay? And hopefully we can quickly come to the conclusion that we can't deal with that, right? So what we're looking for, essentially, this is really getting at, so what David said is exactly the question I'm trying to get at a little bit, or a lot here, is what do we do about this? So if this is broken, we want to understand in what ways it's broken, okay? And we want to understand what can we do about it.
Just to be clear, by broken, what you mean is not perfect.
No, I mean really broken. I'm trying to make an argument that it's very, very broken, and let me get to this. What's that?
The PAM matrix is the average rate of substitution measured over lots of proteins, and you have to be able to explain that. So if you have a more complicated model with differences between sites and things, then you have to show that the average of your more complicated model goes back to the PAM again. So it's not that the PAM has broken, it's the PAM is what it is, which is important, but not everything.
For instance, do you have simple examples where substitutions will be very different, substitution rates will be very different, for instance, in alpha helices and beta sheets. I mean, that would be a, you know, sort of simple illustration of the fact that if you take the average of...
Yeah, and that's been shown a long time ago. They are different. That's been shown a long time ago. So
I guess that's what needs to be put...
But that's... So that's actually what you just said is relatively easy to deal with, and say, okay, the average is different. right? So you've categorized it and you say, here's a different average. Okay, but you've still got the fundamental problem that there's a lot of different sites in the alpha helix. Okay, and you've got the problem that they're changing over time. Let me, so I'm hopefully, at least in principle, given you a rough argument that this is relevant, okay? If I'm right that it's broken in some important aspects, and I'm going to insist on calling it broken in some important ways, okay? We need to think about how to fix it. Okay, so I'm still trying to get where Shelley was talking about. Well, why am I talking about this? Right. This is why I'm talking about this. Okay. So if there's problems, we want to do things like understand where if we have a significant amount of convergence beyond expectation. Understand if we're getting good predictions of ancestral reconstruction. Understand if we are predicting reversions, homoplasy, okay? If we're accurately predicting whether things are reverting back, okay? Whether things are double substituting, okay? That's the fundamental purpose to which we put these matrices. Okay, when we do phylogenetic trees, we're trying to ask, we're inferring backwards on a tree such as this, whether we have phylogenetic signal, we have enough signal versus noise, which is reversion and double mutations, okay, to infer that that branch existed or not. Okay, so if we're not inferring reversion and multiple mutations properly, okay, we're not doing, using this matrix, we're not doing the job to which it's intended. Okay? So, again, this is trying to give you an introduction enough, at least to consider the idea that these matrices are important, and they're important for most evolutionary inferences that we might like to make from molecules. Okay, and if there is a fundamental problem, we need to think about what it is, when it's a problem and when it's not a problem, and as David said, what can we do about it? And what can we do about it without trying to estimate 10 million different parameters, which we can't possibly do. So in answering that, we're asking, is there any consistency? Okay, is there any consistency to the patterns that we see that allow us to say what's probably going on, okay, without making this constant assumption, the assumption that any matrix is constant over time. So for example, okay, what I'm going to point out here, going back to here, is this is a certain amount of consistency. So if I show it like this, these are averages over long periods, many, many sites, many, many transitions. Okay, and what we will see is that they're averages of random processes, random drift processes, but they lead to something that looks like this, which is a transition which says that this amino acid tended to be high when it was resident and tends to drop off over time. So we can ask questions, not just about our simulation system, right? So I don't care about my simulation system all that much, except that it gives me expectations about how an evolutionary process like this, which I think is like the evolutionary process in real proteins, it gives me ideas about what I expect and what I expect to measure. Okay, so if I see, so whether you believe this model or not that I got these results from, what I'm saying from this is that there's a consistency and there are things we can measure. So for example, in the paper that we published, we asked the question, does it tend to be the case that the relative fitness of the resident amino acid that was previously resident after a substitution falls off over time? Okay, and that is the case. Okay, so basically the energies of reverse amino acids, if you take two sequences with two structures, okay, and you ask what's the difference in energy of swapping them back and forth in those structures, you get something exactly like what we're predicting here. roughly, for actually surprisingly accurately. Okay, so we can ask, also then, can we ask details about how slow or fast this process might be in real proteins? Okay, so we can have as our goal to understand things like this and say, what can we measure in real proteins and what does it matter? So I want to go back here to this part and just cover a few things, and these are a few terms I've already said, but I started talking about covolution and epistasis. Okay? Epistasis and genetic. Epistasis is a word that has evolved over time. Geneticists used to use it originally, I think, pretty much to mean you have two variants at two different parts of the genome. And if you look at the phenotypic or selective effect of one variant, and you look at the phenotypic or selective effect of another variant independently, and then you ask when they're together, do they interact with each other? Okay, and you can talk about additive or multiplicative. I don't really care about it, but you're asking about that interaction. So you have the idea of the interaction in the outcome based on two variants. Okay. I've been working on covolution for a long time, what I would call molecular covolution, and that's both within and between molecules. And I would I have defined this as if we have a substitution at one site, okay, over evolutionary time, does that change the probability of substitutions at another site? So can we detect that there is an effect that we had a substitution here that changes the effect there? You can kind of see that those are interrelated concepts. And what I don't want to do here is we can sort of think, oh, maybe covolution, we'll talk about that a little bit more when we talk about long-term evolution, epistasis more on short-term evolution. Although covolutionary, I want to point out that covolutionary effects can happen even though there is no measurable epistasis instantaneously in the substitutions that occur. Okay? In terms of fitness or possibly anything else. So think of these as both substitutes for interacting, okay? One substitution affecting the process of another. Now, I want to talk about adaptation versus nearly neutral evolution. And I'm going to say this relatively quickly, but I'm just going to define this as a useful definition as nearly neutral evolution is what happens when the adaptive landscape does not change. Okay? And then I'm going to say adaptation is some outside force that changes the adaptive landscape. Okay? And in fact, adaptation is what happens as the sequence adjusts to the modification in the adaptive landscape. So I want to throw that out there. Evolutionary, but yes.
So what's bothering me a bit is whether the changes in the protein are, the changes in the other parts of the protein are influencing the fitness at the first site that we thought of, right?
Yes.
So is that adaptation or is that nearly neutral? It depends on the way you look at it, right?
Right, and I'm defining it as if it happens in the rest of the protein, it is by definition not adaptation. Okay, and the reason I'm defining that way is precisely what you're worried about, because in nearly neutral evolution, okay, there is a plenty of selection going on. There is both purifying selection, but there's also occasional directional selection. Right? So yes, it looks like adaptation, and that is exactly the point. So the point here is that this looks like adaptation. And this is a great point, because this is what I'm trying to get, we want to get at, is can we distinguish in the context of understanding really how molecules are evolving, can we better distinguish what we might call adaptation versus not? Okay, and the problem with calling this adaptation okay, is that it's kind of useless. Most of us don't think about adaptation on that level. If you're thinking on the developmental level, the cell biology level, right, you've probably got some possibly vague idea of adaptation as the protein is adjusting to the environment, I would argue. I don't know. I mean, I'm happy to listen to more if people think that that's bad, but I think it gives us some consistency, because otherwise, without making this kind of distinction, and I agree that you might, for different purposes, want to make, you might even consider making it at a higher level, right? But without making this kind of distinction, it gets incredibly confusing. What do we mean by the difference between adaptation and selection? Okay, and when do we get bursts, for example? So we detect adaptation at the molecular level through bursts of substitution, what we call adaptive bursts, right? So when we see a burst of amino acid substitution on a branch relative to neutral expectations, we tend to think that's a signal of potential adaptation, right? And in the past, people would see a burst like that and they'd immediately publish papers and become famous, right? Maybe not. We want to understand that, but if we have sort of what I would call nearly neutral evolution, right, which, remind you, this is in the context of all I'm doing is saying there's a static pressure to fold, right? It's a very simple, most people would call that non-adaptive, right? The protein's under selection to fold properly, and we just let it run, and we don't change anything else about the system. And we can take a vote. How many people think that's a non-adaptive, how many people are comfortable with that as a non-adaptive scenario?
Yes, as long as we know what it means. It's not a non-selected scenario, it's a selected
exactly.
One thing.
It's a constant
so what
selective
I like
pressure.
Whether, if supposing there was one, we consider one protein and all the interactions between the different sites in one protein, will that continue to evolve or will it not? So the what you're telling us here is that changes in the other sites affect the fitness at this site, and now there can be a substitution at this site because the other one's changed. But that implies a kind of frustration that everything is not happy with everything else. I mean, you could imagine a situation where everything would go to somewhere where it was the best, given everything else, and then all substitutions would be deleterious then, and it wouldn't go anywhere. You could imagine it getting stuck. So the fact that your argument doesn't get stuck is telling us something about fitness landscapes of proteins, isn't it? It's telling us something.
Yeah, different. So that's actually something that other people have said a while ago, that it doesn't get stuck. So I'd prefer not to get into it at that level, because that's not something new that I'm saying. Is that fair? I mean, it is true that it's a consequence of just studying things as a, what I call an evolving thermodynamic object. They don't tend to get stuck. It's very hard to get them stuck. And this is what I was saying about the thing about fitness. If you somehow ramp up, I don't know if I have it. I mean, but I was saying that fitness equals the probability of folding, right? If you have a variety of different proteins and you say the absolute contribution to the overall organismal fitness is some proportion of the probability of folding, right? And you say really critical proteins have a very high proportion and less critical proteins have a very, very small proportion. It makes very, very little difference about how those proteins evolve. Am I getting at what you're asking, or am I?
Okay.
I guess a fundamental question here is how frequent is epistasis in proteins? So if you think of
it is a fundamental question.
So if you have if you say the most stable sequence that uses the most stable structure, so let's say you have only one sequence that's supposed to be everything is dependent on everything, but I guess most proteins will be very far from that point, such that
you have a lot of room for substitutions, and in that space, part of the sequence space, maybe then, I mean, if so, static effects are not that frequent, then.
Isn't there a continuum in which it is a matter of what you want to call the static effects and the definition that David has provided here, where there is some small impact on the ability to properly fold the protein, which is what he's talking about by fitness here. A mutation elsewhere, I mean, you might call that an epistatic effect, but it's probably trivially small from a functional perspective.
Well, I mean, let's say that if you have a sequence, and I mean, it's like a lot of the substitutions could improve the stability, which here is the fitness. So so in that sense, so all these substitutions, I guess, would they?
Yeah, I guess so, how strong does an effect need to be before you want to call it an epistatic effect?
Yes.
I mean,
so
that's what
these, what you're saying is the question. Okay, so
we know we have some numbers on that, right? That is, Manuel is suggesting the frequency of clear functional implications of epistatic effects are relatively small, relatively few. But I don't think anyone would dispute.
The clear implications are few?
Sorry, the clear indications of epistatic, of strong epistatic effects on people.
There are many.
I actually would disagree with that. There are quite many at this point.
But relative to the space of possible mutations,
right.
I don't know, is it 1% of interaction that exhibit?
So first off, what I want to argue, and I think is straightforward, is that the percentage of pairwise interactions that are epistatic is probably around 5%. Okay? So if you look at it as a percentage, you could say that's low. Okay? Now, if you look at it, how often you have epistatic interactions, when you square all the possible interactions that have happened over evolutionary time in a protein, you have a lot of epistatic interactions. Does that make sense? So the likelihood, so one of the ways that we know this is important is because we see coevolution. We see strong implications of coevolutionary effects between amino acids. They tend to be proximal in the protein structure, so which is not terribly surprising, right? But they tend to go out, they go out a little bit. They go out into a couple shells of amino acid interactions, at least. They happen on the surface of the proteins. You have epistasis or coevolution due to charge at the surface. They're more strong in a pairwise fashion in alpha helices. Okay, but generally speaking, they're fairly weak at a pairwise level. Okay, and part of the reason for that is that you have a substitution. So let's say you have a substitution, let's say it's slightly deleterious. Okay, how many amino acids might be able to alter to compensate for that? Right, that's the question, and if there's very many, like more than one or two, it's going to be difficult to get a really, really strong pairwise coevolutionary interaction signal. But we nevertheless do have a very strong coevolutionary signal, mutual information signal, whatever we want, you know, different, basically every different measure that tries to measure coevolution, covariation, mutual information comes up with a strong signal that relates to structure. Okay, that's one thing, but let me give you another piece of evidence. So this is just published last year. And this has to do with convergence and divergence. Okay, so let me define terms here a little bit. What we're talking about is if we have two distant branches on an evolutionary tree, okay, we can ask, is there a substitution at the same site in an alignment at these two different parts of the tree? Okay. And I'm going to define this as being convergence if it's substituted to the same thing. Okay? And divergence if it's substituted to different things. Okay? Now, under a lot of evolutionary scenarios, okay, of constant relative substitution rates, okay, we might expect that the level of the amount of convergence due to random chance would be low, and the amount of divergence would be high, and that the ratio of convergence to divergence would be constant. Now, if that's not intuitive, I can try to explain it a little bit more. But in a rough sense, is that roughly intuitive? Okay. Now, the problem, if, as what I'm talking about here, the process is regularly changing over time, okay, that means we have changing substitution probabilities. Okay, and changing substitution probabilities means that the probability of convergence and divergence should change. Okay, and in fact, it should change over time. Okay, so if we plot time, and this is going to be patristic distance, okay, which just means we're comparing two branches and we're looking at the distance from the ancestor of each branch is the patristic difference. So just adding up all the branches that separate them along the tree. If we look at what happens over time, and I'm going to argue that we can look at what is the ratio of convergence to divergence. Okay, we can ask ourselves, what's the expectation of different models of evolution? Okay, and I'm going to put, I may get the number slightly wrong, but this is published. And I'm going to put a scale of 1.0 here, although it can go higher. We can ask, for example, what these standard matrices, what do you expect if a standard matrix like this is operating? Okay. And what you get is something like this. Pretty low. There's actually a little bit of a dip, but not a lot of a dip.
So can we just define the C's and the D's properly? So
this is the sum of the number of convergence events between I and J, and this is branch equals IJ.
So it's a convergence is when two sites that were different become the same again, right? It's when
two sites
different amino acids at this point, and one of them mutates and becomes the same as the first.
Right, so if you have substitutions at these two branches, one of them changes, right? It's now possibly was already different, and I'll get to that in a moment, possibly was the same already, right? But at least is different now, okay? And then the other site changes, and if it changes to the same endpoint, that's a convergent. Okay, so it had at least one divergence event occurring, and then it went close together, which is not the usual expectation for evolution. Randomly, although it happens at some probabilistic frequency.
And is it the rate?
This is the measure. This is measured. This is something we can measure in real proteins in a real phylogenetic tree, and we're measuring this on mitochondrial genomes, of which we have many now. I think this was approximately 600 plus genome mitochondrial genomes. So that's what a lot of the data is measured on. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I got lost again.
Sure.
So we're talking about the convergence divergence on a single locus, or we're looking at the genome here?
So what?
If I understand you correctly, you were talking about the dependence on the rest of the genome, right? Dependence on genetic context, right? You're talking about the spaces.
Right. So
are we talking about the convergence,
right,
of a single row of a 20 by 20 matrix, or a single entry?
So this is something which I'm trying to explain, we can definitionally measure, which we could, we can calculate this for a gene or a genome or a set of genes or anything we want. Okay, so yes, we could look at this on the individual site level, but what I'm talking about here is an average across the entire genome.
Without marginalizing over the rest of the genome. My problem is, yeah. Genetic space is very, very long, right? So, typically when we sort of hope for any sort of equilibrium, we sort of start marginalizing, and then we can talk about whether there is an equilibrium reached even then, right? But very naively, I'd say, if we're talking about the whole genome, then there's certainly many more ways of diverging than converging, right? So
right, and that's my
point. The expectation
this is my point.
For that,
and that's
number, therefore,
this is why this is low.
So all I'm saying
is we can ask. We can say we measure this, right? And we can also say, given a matrix, can we predict exactly what we should see? Okay, so if a given matrix holds across a bunch of sites, we can say, what kind of convergence-divergence would you expect? And so for most matrices that we use that are constant matrices, it's exactly what you said, is we expect a lot more divergence than convergence. Okay? And that means that our expectation, given that matrix, is low, right? So what I'm trying to get here is to say we have this thing that we can act, we can consider C over D, we can consider expectations of C over D, given a model of evolution, and then we can say, what do we see in a real data set? Because this is something we can measure in a real data set.
So that makes sense? About around 0.05, 0.1 in your
mind? It's about 0.05. Yeah, this is decreasing a little bit. This is probably starting out at 0.1 to 0.05. Yeah.
So then if I understand you correctly, you're defining the CD as the property of a transition matrix, in that particular case, M matrix. Right?
Yep.
And then from the mitochondria, we can have a different matrix, and therefore different.
In the mitochondria, we can have different matrix, or we can have a set of matrices that are changing across sites and over time. Okay. So we can ask, what is our expectations? Okay, for things that change over time, and it happens to be that with our model of epistatic interactions due to something evolving as a thermodynamic object, we expect a curve more like this. So what, now I want to get to what this is, and I'll say too that we can, this is an over, what I've drawn so far is an overall curve of expectations of C over D, and we can also say here, is this ancestor of both branches the same or different, okay, which has a contribution. But we can ask, if this ancestor is the same, okay, does it change? And in fact, we see a more linear decreasing curve, okay, if the ancestor is the same. Yes?
Maybe I'm missing something here, but how is what you're saying different from saying that the likelihood of independent substitutions, and by independent I mean at different parts of the tree,
yes,
is higher than what you would predict from the PAM matrix, and that it is higher still if it's starting from the same place, but that it is basically that's really the comparison that you're making.
So let's go with this one. This is the common ancestor. Okay? So as it turns out, our expectation is flat if the matrices do not change over time. Okay? Yeah, so that's how it's different. So if we have different matrices, if we've misestimated the matrix, if we said it changes across sites, okay, we can have questions about how well we've estimated all of those different matrices, and we should question that because we can't really measure it very well. But nevertheless, if we have some combination of matrices that are all constant, we will have a flat line with C or D. So I'm making that assertion.
And the argument for epistasis here is not any individual comparisons, but the fact that that over time these have diverged from a different background. So this larger difference that you're seeing early on is a consequence of the parents being closer, and so you're sort of summing epistatic interactions across the whole protein. Is that the point?
So
I'm not understanding.
This is really pretty high. Okay. So what we can also consider this is that the C over D ratio is related to a measure of the number of accessible amino acids at any time. Okay? So if there's only one amino acid, the resident amino acid, you're not going to have any change, you're not going to have anything to measure. Okay? If there's only two amino acids, there's only one amino acid that anything can change to. Okay? And as long as it hasn't changed yet, it's going to contribute to convergence because it can't diverge. Okay, but if there's three amino acids, there's two possibilities. That is, we're doing this conditional on there's a substitution, right? We're conditional on there's a substitution at both branches. Okay, so if there's two other amino acids, there's two choices. Right, so I hope that's just a simple combinatoric, how many choices are going to the same thing and how many choices are going to different things. Right, and that keeps going up with more and more amino acids. Okay. But the ratios that we observe in real proteins, the instantaneous ratios, both in theoretic and real proteins, are such that the probability is the amount of constraints that is there on at any particular site in the protein at any time is very low. So basically, if we call, I was going to write N effective, let me do little n, F, not to be confused with the effective population size, but we can talk about the effective number of amino acids. Actually, I'm going to do this, how about amino acid effective, right? We can say what's the mean amino acid effective at any site, right? And the instantaneous mean effective amino acid at any site is pretty low. So it's usually in the range of 1 to 3. Okay. That changes over time. So what we consider is, let's say this is an alanine. Okay, it's in the state of an alanine, and at some point in time, it has a pretty good probability of going to proline and leucine. Okay? Now, if this fluctuates over time at some later time, and it's alanine, and it's going to, let's say, isoleucine, and I don't know what's anybody's favorite amino acid.
Serine.
Thank you. Serine. Okay. So if the site is diverged such that these two are acceptable at one point in time and these two are acceptable at another point in time, what's going to be the expectation at this distant point in time for convergence? It's a pretty easy number. Is this site going to converge? Different amino acids are acceptable. By definition, they can't go to the same thing. So the expectation for convergence is going to be zero. Okay? So what we're talking about is that there's a process where things are fluctuating over time. Okay? And this fall off in this process is caused by both the fact that the reason that it's high is caused by high degree of constraint instantaneously at any point in time. Okay, which, by the way, is very compatible with what, I hate to cite ENCODE, but what ENCODE estimates is the amount of constraint, the average amount of constraint on amino acids, okay? Which is high, that is, there's very few amino acids that are usually acceptable at most sites at any instant. And that changes over time. So think consequences. You can read the paper and you can decide whether you believe me or not. Okay, but if this is true, which I say that it is, we need to, oh, obviously, I should add, this is in mitochondria, we need to look at all proteins, and we need to get a better estimation if there's conditions under which it varies and doesn't matter, and somewhere it does. But, Dan, what's it going to do to ancestral reconstruction predictions?
Yeah, well, it affects a lot of things, potentially.
So it affects very, very many things. So it affects... It will affect ancestral, your confidence in ancestral reconstruction. It's going to affect your confidence in whether you have a reversion or not, okay, which is very much the same as saying it affects your confidence in whether you can reconstruct a phylogenetic tree properly. Okay. And also very importantly, there's a problem, is if we want to use convergence, if we want to use amino acid convergence as a measure of adaptation, okay, we've got a problem, because not only is the height of this difficult to estimate, but how it changes over time is difficult to estimate. And what we don't want to do is go, yahoo, we see lots of convergence. Convergence is happening everywhere. Adaptation is happening universally everywhere in all genomes. Because if you don't take this into account, you're going to say adaptation and convergence are happening almost universally everywhere. Making some sense? Yes, no? Is it enough to think that maybe what I'm saying when I say I think using a constant matrix is broken? Okay, so think about what I've said is you can't, if you use a constant matrix, you get very bad estimates of the amount of substitution you expect at any time. You have very bad estimates of the amount of convergence you expect at any time. You have very bad estimates of the amount, the number of effective amino acids you expect at any one time. So if I draw a graph of omega, which I'm going to define omega in the standard way as the substitution rate relative to neutral expectations, that is, relative to the nucleotide substitution processes if there were no purifying selection. Okay, so we can say, what is our expectation for that? And we can say, we could compare this to the effective number of permissible amino acids, okay? And let me make sure I got this right. This is about 1.0. This is going up to a scale of 21. Okay, if we look at most of the constant matrices, then I'm just giving abbreviations. Some of you may have heard of different ones. blossom, right? They're up here. Okay, so I'm going to put them in this range. That is a high number of effective amino acids, or effective number of permissible amino acids, and a very low reduction in the substitution rate due to that constraint. Okay? If we consider cat models, and cat is a family of models, let me get this about right. This is in the range of 0.4 to 0.6. They're going to be around here. Okay, so cat models are models that allow the process to vary among sites, and they're mixture models. I'm not going to go into all the details, but this is about allowing for a reasonable amount of variation among sites. Okay, if we take PFAM, which is a database of alignments of protein domains, right, and we look at the amino acid frequencies that are observed in PFAM, we can make a similar sort of calculation, and it kind of fills a range like this.
What's your vertical axis again here?
This, that's terribly done. This is omega. Okay, so this is the proportional reduction in the rate. Okay, so all of these are pretty high. This is, you know, maybe this extends to 0.3. No, not even 0.3, really 0.4. Okay. Now, if we ask what does UNCODE estimate is a typical omega value, they're usually in the range down here. Okay, and that's in, and that's basically all of these are kind of following a curve. So you're getting an effective, a small effective number of amino acids and a lot of constraint on the evolutionary rate due to that small number of effective amino acids. Okay, so this is just measuring, when we're talking about UNCODE, that's just measuring the essentially the effective number of amino acids and what the reduction in the rate should be. So what this is saying is all of these things are making predictions that do not well predict what we actually observe in terms of the reduction in rate and the reduction in effective number of amino acids. Okay, but this is very compatible with what I'm saying about the idea that at any time you have a small number of effective number of permissible amino acids, and which specific amino acids they are vary over time.
So your omega is the DNDS, the same omega as is in the codon substitution model, is it? Because they call that omega.
Yeah, that's exactly why I use this one.
Right.
Yep. Let me double check. Okay, got 9 minutes. So what I want to do is transition out of the easy stuff into thinking about this as reaction rate theory. So just roughly, and this gets back to what David says, we want to ask what questions do we want to ask, what questions do we need to know, and how can we address this in a reasonable way where we're not simply over-parameterizing the situation. So, what I want to think is, if we consider normal reaction rate kinetics, we have two molecules, A and B, right, and we have an energy landscape, right, and normally the molecule is hanging out in a small, and low down in the landscape, and occasionally it moves up to the transition state where you might have delta G of the transition state, and the delta G of the transition state determines the probability that you go to that transition state, therefore that you go over the hump, and it determines the K of A going to B, right? So we can understand a little bit about chemical reaction theory in terms of a landscape like this, okay, where X is just simply sort of the reaction coordinate moving along. Now, if we consider further a guy named Kramers, right, he realized that this theory isn't perfect because basically what it's assuming is when you make this transition, okay, when you go up to the transition state and you move to B, that's irreversible, and you immediately equilibrate into the thermodynamic well of B. Okay, but I realize that assumption's not true, even for molecules. Okay, and the thing that happens, in fact, that you can take account of, is that this is a little bit of a plateau, and they can move slowly along this plateau, and even here, you might move slowly back and forth in this reaction coordinate space. Okay, now, this has implications for how reactions proceed. And an important concept here, what's sort of controlling whether you make big jumps or little jumps, is something called viscosity. Right? So in terms of chemical reactions, you can think of that as, okay, a force that impinges on a molecule and gives it more energy. Right, but things are going to happen. It's going to lose energy to the environment. It's going to lose energy to, if it's in water, if it's in molasses, it's going to move more slowly. So if you just think about, so for example, diffusion, right? If you look at Brownian motion, it's going to go more slowly in molasses than it necessarily is in water, and it's certainly going to go more slowly than it would in a gas. Okay, so we have this diffusion. So we can think about, so you might notice, we can think about this very similarly and think, does the substitution process translate into something like this, okay, where we've got a well, so we're spending a lot of time in the well where A is acceptable and B is not, okay, and likewise, if we're in B, we're going to spend a lot of times in the well where B is acceptable and A is not. Okay, and there's going to be some transition point in the middle. Okay, and mind you, I'm showing this in two dimensions, two amino acids, but of course there's 20, and you would want to take that into account. But there's a transition point, and it isn't necessarily the sequence, considering this site. Right, and you're basically, what you're considering is, what is the rest of the sequence doing to the site in terms of moving it along this reaction coordinate away from this transition state, or vice versa, if it's far from the transition state, moving it towards the transition state. Okay, so what that means then is we can think of what this is going to happen in terms of amino acid evolution. Okay, is that we can think of it, is that there's a sort of hidden state, potentially, whereby this particular amino acid site is unlikely to change to anything because it's very comfortable with the amino acid that's there. Okay, and it might, depending on how far away from a transition state it is, it might take some time to drift over to this transition state. And that time is going to control the rate at which it evolves to B, because it has to both move to the transition state where it can go to B, and then it has to have a random substitution that changes it to B. Okay, and furthermore, if it changes to B, it might change back, because by definition, it's in a transition state when it changed to B. So it's very easy at this time point to change back to A. Okay, so you get this transition period where you can, be going forward and you can going backwards, right? Now we can consider this, what we have here in phylogenetics is this thing that we're translating from molecules is happening to, in slow motion on a phylogenetic tree, right? So we can consider this potentially as a hidden state where it became active, it became likely to substitute, right? But it might not have substituted, it might have substituted actually only on a couple of places, right? And this one might have been reverted backwards, right? But then over time, if it didn't substitute, what are all the branches that didn't substitute? Let's do another one just for fun. Right, those things would tend to revert back to out of the transition state and be no longer likely to substitute as much.
Yeah, how does that differ from sort of the rates that come out of near-neutral theory in terms of fixing of a neutral allele being one over the fact of population size in terms of generations? Or
so that is what determines the transition state. So this transition state is where delta S is approximately 1 over 2n, if we're doing it in a diploid. So the selective difference between A and B is essentially neutral. So to a first approximation, we can assume most of this happens as neutral or nearly neutral substitutions.
But in terms of the rates you're talking about and you're drawing them on the tree, I'm just curious as to
So what we're talking about, so this is really where we are right now in terms of developing this theory, is saying, can we measure this, right? So what our prediction is that there should be some amount in certainly amino acids of latency, where that is you're not changing and you're unlikely to change, and so the rate of substitution is low, right? And then you change to a hidden state where delta S is approximately 1 over 2n, where it's approximately neutral, and then you're going to have chance occurrences of neutral substitutions. And then you're going to revert back. So whether you move to B or you revert back to A or stay A, you're going to tend to wander into these wells.
And the rate of that process depends on how many epistatic positions there are and the mutation rate of those
right. But we don't have to know that. What we can ask is, can we measure this rate? And can we ask, how does it vary? So for example, does it vary according to the conservation of the position?
So this brings us back. Can I ask the first question I asked right at
yeah.
Which was this time.
And this will be the last one.
Yeah, that we're just about done.
It was. You're saying that this second one has to drift up there until it's nearly neutral before the substitution can happen. Whereas the alternative is that it stays down here, and then the visibility is mutation, and then it goes up and flips up. That was my first question, is why does this have to happen before? Okay.
Well, if this doesn't happen, this would be a deleterious mutation, which is less probable.
Yes.
Right.
So, but the question is, why does it behave in such a? Why is this ever possible? I mean, it's non-trivial.
Why does it drift?
The fact that some of them become nearly neutral when they weren't in the first place is some non-trivial result about your thermodynamic model.
I think it's a non-trivial result, yeah. And so the question is, I mean, our thermodynamic model is a toy model, right? I don't think it's specifically predicting exactly what's happening in any one protein, but I think it is a generally true model, and it's a model that makes predictions. So it makes hard predictions, right?
It seems to predict that there's big fluctuations in the fitnesses of the other amino acids of that cycle.
Well, I've drawn these as relatively big, but yeah, I mean, I think that these fluctuations, so I didn't get into that, but I mean, these are obviously, for some amino acids, the fluctuations are likely to be rare that they'll reach a neutral range.
If it didn't draw any scale on that, I mean,
right.
if you accept, as I trust we all do, that there are such things as near neutral mutations, then that basal point may be near neutral to begin with.
It could be.
Just down below what you call it.
And if it's a similar amino acid, it probably will be. So if we're talking about leucine and isoleucine, we rescale this where this is maybe slightly deleterious going to completely neutral, right? But if we're talking about aspartic acid and phenylalanine, this might be a big jump and happen rarely, and therefore substitutions are rare. Yeah?
Okay, but the question is, does the response of the P happen before the event? It's like your curve says something has to happen before the transition can happen, right? As opposed to a transition happens, which is
it does. And let me say one thing.
Deleterious mutation which screws things up, and then the rest.
Let me add one last thing, okay? Which and then let's let people out of here. Which is just that one of my motivations for this is that I think that these things that happen are substitutions that relate to the structure. Okay, so I think that these substitutions will occur, and that they'll tend to occur, whether they're close in structure or in some predictable fashion, and that by having a model like this that is perhaps more correct, that we will be better able to predict the effects of structure and substitutions that affect another substitution. Okay, which otherwise we have a great deal of difficulty doing, and we've had a lot of lack of success, and that's something that a lot of people would like to see happen. And I think that this is the route to making that happen. So let's let people out of here. We can argue for the next week about this. Or beyond. All right. Anyway, this was an experimental thing to do with this talk, and maybe every step of it didn't go as smoothly as it might have. But I hope it was, to some extent, fun to talk about things in a more conversational, exploratory way than just me recounting nice, pretty graphs of all my results. So, anyway, thanks for listening.